Yeah, what I'm hoping for is, I have an agenda, and the agenda's here, and it's fucking obvious. First of all, everybody knows antibiotic resistance is a great career opportunity. There's no question about that. I never sat on the front of an airplane before I started working on antibiotic resistance, and the best thing is not just getting there before everybody else. The thing that has been getting to me increasingly so is the focus on resistance. I mean, people tend to forget that antibiotics do more than select for resistance. You sort of see paper after paper, even, for example, that paper the other day on the term, the concern was resistance, emerging resistance, not just recurrence of the infection, but resistance. So I have this agenda that make it clear that antibiotics do more than select for resistance. But I was originally going to give this as a talk, and then Boris, I think, appropriately felt that the phage stuff was more relevant to the general theme of this meeting. So I was going to give two elements of that talk, but both of them one is published, the other one is in press. So it's kind of embarrassing anyhow, giving a talk on work that has already been done. So this is the one that's in press. I just got the galley proofs today. You're welcome to the papers, including the unpublished ones and so on. This is Fernando Becerro, long-term collaborator and very close friend, brother. Ingrid McCall is my lab manager, and Pierre Oncoma is an MD PhD student who's now doing a residency at Mass General. And so there are two real doctors on this paper and two artificial doctors on this paper. Well, Ingrid's not. So the questions we wanted to address, that's not working, whatever. And the other part of the talk was going to be on far more molecular than I usually get, is how antibiotics actually work. And this may seem funny to you that, you know, people have been working with antibiotics for 60 years or more, and it's not at all clear how they kill. And there's a big controversy. Jim Collins at MIT has been involved in the controversy. He had the audacity to present a hypothesis about how antibiotics actually kill. And the in-crowd really, I think, got pissed off that somebody out in the out-crowd was suggesting a general hypothesis about how antibiotics kill. And he was suggesting this ribosome, reactive oxygen species as a general mechanism, and had evidence in his support, but he hadn't done the anaerobic experiments. But it's sort of interesting to me that, you know, that these people that were attacking Jim Collins for his hypothesis weren't presenting an alternative. So it's not clear, for example, how streptomycin kills. They'll talk about toxic byproducts and shit like that, but it's never really clear. And we try to address the same kind of question for ribosome targeting bacteriostatic antibiotics, and that was published earlier, so I'm not going to go over that. What I am really counting on is a discussion. So that was going to be my talk, and I'm not going to give that talk. What we do get is really apocalyptic predictions about the end of the earth. I guess before the recent election we had, I thought that may have been the reason for the end of the earth, but now we have two possible. So there was a report called the O'Neill Report in Britain, and tracking drug resistance, and they present this particular argument that by 2050 there's going to be 10 million deaths due to antibiotic resistance, some $50 billion and so on. And so it's going to become the major cause of mortality. You could just sort of see looking at it compared to, say, cancer and so on. And I think it's just bullshit. It's apocalyptic, but I think it's almost certainly bullshit. I don't think we're anything close to that. And there's a question, it's worth going over the data. So if somebody dies of an antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you have to ask the question whether they would have died if it was susceptible. And it's not at all clear always. So it's a great career opportunity, and people like to start with this stuff. But I think it's questionable whether it's going that way. Well, on the other hand, there is no question that the frequency of pathogens that are genetically resistant to one or more antibiotics and the number of drugs has been increasing. But not all, so the group A strep resistance is not a problem. Pneumococcus, you could still use penicillin for pneumococcus. So it's not as if it's certainly a bad thing, and people are truly dying of antibiotic-resistant infections that would have otherwise survived. But it's not at all clear how really great that is. We know the cost of treating is greater. That you have some with them. There was a study maybe 15 years ago where they actually hired a consulting company to ask what's the cost of MRSA in hospitals, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. The cost in mortality was very high relative to Staphylococcus susceptible in that study. The cost in dollars was not as high, not very high, in part because these people were dying and going out of the hospital. So there was that other side to it. And they didn't really get at the dynamics of the patients that were dying and not. So, I think it's an open question that the magnitude. The rate of introduction of new antibiotics has in fact declined. Drugs like daptomycin, there's been all sorts of wonderful diagrams about when drugs are introduced and when drug resistance becomes problematic. But there's been not very many real new drugs, and in part there's a lot of effort now, or at least a lot of discussion about alternatives to antibiotics. We've even been using combinations of phage and antibiotics. And there's a lot more interest in that, in part driven by this great apocalyptic interpretation. If we get transmissible resistance, so that if you're infected with, say, MRSA and you're being treated with a beta-lactam antibiotic or methicillin or oxacillin, it's certainly the antibiotic's not working. The question is, what if you're infected with a susceptible? How important is resistance? And that's what we're particularly interested in. So people are dying would have been cleared with a pathogen susceptible to the treating antibiotic. But what about resistance acquiring? And the other thing that really strikes me is that most of the focus on antibiotic use in design is really for lethal infection, potentially lethal infections in hospitals and so on. 90% of antibiotic use is in the community. Forgetting animals. So that 90% of antibiotic use is in the community. And the amount of difference is profound in terms of antibiotic use. So the Netherlands are a bunch of cheap souls who use about a third as much antibiotics as they do in Greece and France. And the United States is in this range too. We're not cheap.
How much is it in livestock production and so on?
Oh, this is not livestock.
How does it compare with what's used?
I think the numbers I heard, people say most of much of it's used for livestock. The Netherlands has very low rates of resistance relative to, say, some of the countries that have more, but they use more antibiotics in livestock than most. So, I mean, it's great to blame, you know, the agricultural use, and probably maybe some of the genes evolved in that. But I don't think in terms of spread in humans, I think it's mostly human use of antibiotics.
Isn't it forbidden to use antibiotics in Europe now?
Like, sorry?
In agriculture, I think they don't use antibiotics anymore in Europe, in the European Union.
But I think you need an indication, right? So you have to have theoretically, you have to have...
Yeah, I mean, whether they're using it, it used to be used for growth promotion, and still is.
You can't do that.
What?
You can't do that.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether, then how come they're using so much antibiotic for that if they're not using it for growth promotion? Are these animals so sick?
They probably find a way around it, but.
I'm not really prepared to do it, but if needed, we could rant on about it, but I don't think that's. What I really think is interesting and important is to deal with how we're prescribing antibiotics for humans. Because I think that's... So, as a consequence of this, in that paper that I just said, we're particularly interested in acute infections in the community. So there's some big unanswered questions. The question is the increase in frequency monotonic? And I don't think it is. I mean, it seems to be leveling off. You have episodes like the carbapenem resistance coming up and going down the Acinetobacter baumii and things like that. But I think overall, you know, as I said, you don't see the resistance in group A strep. You don't see the resistance in
correlates pretty well with usage, right? So in a particular community.
Roughly. No, it's certainly associated, you know. Yeah, no, but not as cleanly as you may want.
But it does suggest that if you stop using a particular antibiotic in one country, resistance against that will go down and kind of recover some of it.
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. There was a thing in Sweden where they stopped using the... I think it was the sulfonamides and had no effect. And, we have this whole question of fitness cost of resistance. But I think mostly it's a lot of clonal replacement. You know, I mean, I think certainly if we stopped antibiotic use. On the other hand, we did some baby shit studies and we isolated bacteria, E. coli, from they're resistant to streptomycin, chloramphenicol. Half of them were resistant, and this is in a daycare, half of them were resistant to the penicillins. About 25% were resistant to streptomycin. Streptomycin hasn't been used in ages. It was used for tuberculosis treatment. These kids have never seen streptomycin. So I was told that they use some streptomycin for treating fruit, so that you don't get blemishes. But I suspect we're seeing mostly associated linkage selection because these plasmids confer resistance to multiple antibiotics. So if you're using ampicillin, the other resistances come up. And so I think, is it monotonic? I think it's a good question to be asking a little bit. Are we just increasing? Because implicit in that O'Neill report was that we're just going to get everybody's going to be resistant. How much can we actually reduce it by the more prudent use? It's a good modeling question of epidemiological modeling, less frequent use. If the infecting population is susceptible to the treating, how much will the magnitude in term of morbidity of infections and likelihood of mortality increase by resistance, what's called acquired resistance, evolving during therapy? That is, if you have a susceptible infection you're treating, you obviously have intense selection against resistance. But are people dying? Does that lead to treatment failure? And I think you have to separately consider for elderly and immune-compromised patients? Is that really a source of mortality? And for chronic infections like TB, we know acquired resistance is a source of treatment failure, evolving during the course of therapy. But what we're particularly interested in is acute infections in immune-competent hosts. Your kid gets otitis media. You get sinusitis, you get vaginitis, and you're taking an antibiotic. Trends in Micro, we're sort of referring to as lifestyle drugs, because we are. If you're using it to improve the quality of your life, you know, you reduce the term of morbidity and magnitude of morbidity, that's a really good use of antibiotics. But you wouldn't have died of the infection, so it's not a matter of lethality. We're particularly interested in those. So
in terms of the severity of the problem in clinical terms, what do you think is more important? Like, is it the transmissible elements or is it the spontaneous mutations?
Well, that's what I would like to. I think the transmissible is no question. That is, if you're infected with the wrong drug and you're treated with that drug, then treatment's going to not be. But there's less and less excuse for that. So, for example, MRSA is, you know, the frequency is very high. But there are these procedures, instead of doing lab tests, you know, where you isolate the bacteria, which takes about 3 days to find out. You do it by a PCR-based method, and you know in 3 hours. If it's a common one, there's no excuse for, you know, for the common ones to be treating. And I think molecular techniques and early diagnosis are going to take care of that. So I think instead of, right now it's based on frequency, so the physicians will stop using it when the frequency gets to be so high. And we wrote a paper showing that if you have that kind of regulation, you know, using an SIR type epidemiological model, you would level off the frequency if, in fact, people stop using it when the frequency reaches a particular level, which is certainly what's happening. And so you would get, instead of, if you do an SIR model for drug resistance, you're either below the threshold where it increases or above the threshold where it goes to one, you can manipulate that by various other. So, I mean, my purpose is really, you know, in addition to advertising what we do, which I'm not going to try and minimize, but rather say there's really cool questions there at varieties of levels, at the clinical level, and so on.
To follow up on that, I mean, don't you think the acquisition of like transmissible elements are like binary events, right? I mean, they either happen or not, right? I mean, selecting for them is expediting this. But the other ones, you know, if you don't have the resistance gene around, right? I mean, this thing will not happen. But like on the other hand, if you have bacteria and if you're using the gyrase inhibitor, you will get
Our models always assume that there's a minority population of resistance. So that's, you know, the question is, there's two elements, and I'd like to sort of, there's two elements. There's what they, you know, acquired, you know, genetic resistance, and then there's the phenotypic resistance, sometimes called persistence. And so the question is, what is the effect of that on the course of therapy? Of either of those, in our models, we're always assuming there's a minority population of resistance, because that's sort of the case you should be considering. And the question is, will they ascend? And our models now are using sort of a combination of the immune system and antibiotics. So the question in that trends paper is, we're arguing that if the phagocytosis is great enough, then the infection will be cleared. It'll be relatively independent of the kind of antibiotic, and also minority populations where resistance will not ascend, and you could use lower doses. If in fact, and that's what we're doing that experimentally now with Bordetella, with Eric Harvell. So, I mean, it leads to testable hypotheses. And there's a whole group of Andrew Reed and that collective have been arguing for low-dose chemotherapy based on a competition mechanism. And we're sort of saying if the immune system is sufficient, these are for acute infections. But one of our criticisms is that of the enterprise is that, so this will give you an idea of just how different antibiotics can be. These are what we call time kill experiments. So you get the bacteria growing, then you introduce the antibiotic, and at this time it's 10 times the minimum inhibitory dose, and then look at the rate of survival. And there are a few things that I want to point out here. One of which is the phenomenon of just, first of all, these are bacteriostatic drugs. This is Staph aureus. And these are bacteriostatic drugs, erythromycin, tetracycline, and linazolid. I mean, and another one would be chloramphenicol. And so the macrolides, like azithromycin, they're bacteriostatic. In the sense, by bacteriostatic, we're saying there's a really low rate of mortality, like 0.1, minus 0.1 per hour. Whereas if I take, say, gentamicin, the rate of kill is about minus 8 per hour. So we're really talking profoundly different. And one of the things we try to explain in this TIM paper, which is really an opinionated review, is why antibiotics of these different types are equally effective for treating acute infections. I mean, people, you know, there's a choice. People prefer, of course, antibiotics that kill because it sounds better. There's so much intuition. But when you look, there was a meta-analysis, and there was no difference between static and cidal drugs for treating acute infections. And, you know, and these are not trivial antibiotics. I mean, chloramphenicol we don't use because of aplastic anemia, which was rare, but it's an amazingly good drug. I mean, an amazing drug. It pretty much dealt with typhoid, fever, you know, it was a drug of choice. But it was bacteriostatic, not bactericidal. And you can see, and this is the phenomenon of persistence, by the way, so that we kill at a high rate, and then we end up with about 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 cells. We don't go any lower. And if I treat these with other, first of all, if I repeat the experiment, it's entirely phenotypic. That is, if I get the same dynamics as we get. But if I treat these with another antibiotic, they're refractory. And the idea of why they're refractory is that they're dividing very slowly or not dividing. And so there's a minority population. This is
what do you mean by refractory?
What?
What do you mean by refractory?
Oh, by refractory, if I take another antibiotic and put it in, we're not going to kill them either.
Is there a reason, or what's the explanation as to why an antibiotic kill curve, at least in the initial stages, is exponential? I mean, I don't think of antibiotics as going into a cell and a single event happens and the cell dies. I think of it as a slow buildup of a bunch of damage. But that's...
Yeah, well, you're asking about the mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it does go exponential initially, and it varies with the drug. In some cases, there's a delay, and then it starts killing. Well, we're looking at the population level, and we really should be looking at what you guys have been doing at the single cell level, and I'll give you a good reason why. You know, what is happening? You know, we're sort of, if we take the bacteriostatic antibiotics, we get very low rate of kill, and I'll show sub-MIC kill curves. Are we increasing the rate of death? Are we reducing the rate of cell division? And it turns out to be more complicated than both. I mean, and there's some all sorts of interesting stuff that I think has largely been neglected of what's happening. And I've been trying to convince Lynn since he was a student to do, no, Harvard, to do it.
Isn't the question says, you know, the drugs on the right-hand side have very steep killing curves?
So a drug like, say, gentamicin and ciprofloxacin, this is rifampin, I didn't label it. They have very steep kill curves. But other drugs that are very effective, like vancomycin and oxicillin is methicillin, have very shallow kill curves.
Aren't they also like a step function?
What?
In our hands, they're pretty steep as well.
No, I mean, these will continue to kill for a while. So, I mean, this is going only 8 hours. Now, I don't know whether I put but this is referred to as pharmacodynamics. And what people do is use minimum inhibitory. And I'm going to talk about this sort of what I call the PK/PD mafia and what they do.
But this killing rate is going to depend critically on how fast you're growing.
It does. I mean, if they're not growing,
they're
stationary phase. But even that's complicated.
Yeah.
So gentamicin will kill stationary. We're now looking at things that kill persisters. That is, if I treat with a bacteriostatic antibiotic, then they're refractory to killing by most antibiotics. And we're now looking at the relationship between the ones that are. So people knew for years that if you treat with chloramphenicol, you don't treat with penicillin, because chloramphenicol was preventing replication, penicillin was not working. But that turns out to be generally true for all of the bacteriostatic antibiotics. So though there's an abundance of nutrients, the cidal antibiotics are not working. And Jim Collins and his students showed, first of all, a very low rate of metabolism with the bacteriostatic antibiotics. This is a reality that this is a staph aureus, so it's not a and we've worked with MRSA, and MRSA is sensitive to lots of antibiotics and not just vancomycin. There's one called USA 300. I love it. I don't know who some sort of team. Anyways, it's very invasive, but it was a community acquired one. Anyway, so this is the kind of thing that we're particularly interested in, is how this ultimately turns into treatment. And
do you get the stagnation independent of the density they are at? Like how, or do they need some signal of dying cells around them
you're asking, in this case, the cells can grow up to 10 to the 9, as you can see in the control.
Yeah, well, but they're only at 1,000 when they stop.
Yeah, they go down.
But if there were less cells around or not so many dying, I don't know how you would do that.
If I treated fewer cells, we're not going to get, we actually have a paper that persistence is really just a kind of shit happens, like mutation. Not an evolved character. That is, a fraction of the population doesn't divide.
So it's like in Lynn's same exact was a much higher variance.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's but there's a lot of interest in persistence because it's an interesting phenotype. Why do you get? There's a toxin, antitoxin method. People make their whole careers just studying persistence.
You don't believe that they can get signals from dying cells around them? Because
probably, yeah. I don't want to think of that much sociology. I'd like to think of them as, but you're right. There's lots of, and I'll show you data that's even. No, I mean, I'm trying to just give you an overview of what this enterprise is all about.
But you can see, people have done this at the single cell level, right? Where you look at single cells and you come with the antibiotic and you see which ones die and which ones persist. And it, I mean,
Okay, so I don't think people have very carefully checked your thing, but if you just look at the pictures of what's happening, it doesn't really look like it's a signaling thing. It really looks like it's a stochastic thing. Some just happen to be in a state where they won't die.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I would interpret Nathalie Balaban's work that way.
For example,
suggesting that it's... I mean, what we argued in this paper is that it's like mutation. That is, what is interesting is, in the case of mutation, we don't have to explain mutation evolutionarily. We have to explain mutation rates, which involve all sorts of... Now, this is what I call the PKPD mafia's approach. Obviously, there's an editorial element in just describing it that way. This is the pharmacokinetics. This is sort of a standardized interpretation of pharmacokinetics. You introduce the antibiotic, and its concentration will reach a particular level, all measured in serum, and then its concentration will wane over a period of time. And what they do is they do this empirically with volunteers, rarely sick people. And they'll just give them a dose of an antibiotic orally or by injection, and then follow the changes in the concentration in the serum, usually by HLPC. And so there's three measures of pharmacokinetics that they use. One is the peak antibiotic concentration. Another one is the time above the minimum inhibitory concentration. And another common one is the area under the curve. That would be the numerator of a PKPD index. The denominator, although there more, is the minimum inhibitory concentration. And the way you measure a minute, well, it's measured by machine, but if you do it in a lab or something, you have, this is called an E-test. We have a strip of a gradient of antibiotic concentration, put it on a lawn of sensitive cells, and the MIC, you would read off here where it's no longer working. The other way we do it is by serial dilution. Let's say we put 10 micrograms here, 5, 2.5, and serially dilute and wait to the point where you're stopping, you're no longer getting growth. If you do these experiments and it varies between drugs, you really have a continuum, but let us say they would decide MIC is here. So 10, 10, 5, 2.5, 1.25, 0.625, and that would be called the MIC. And there's a way, it has to be done in a particular way. If it's going to be an official MIC, it has to be 5 times 10 to the 5 cells. Let's say we're taking staff. And it has to be measured at 18 hours. And in medium, that is, bacteria grow well. I mean, MICs, and the criteria for resistance, which we don't call resistance, I mean, the politically correct term for the people that work in this area, is non-susceptibility, and they have breakpoints. So let us say the MIC of a susceptible strain is 1 microgram per mil. You get 2 micrograms per mil, they'll decide that's a breakpoint. And there's a committee that meets and decides what the breakpoints are. In some cases, it's really very profound. So if I take, say, MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph, the MIC of susceptible is about 1 microgram per mil, actually less. The MIC of MRSA is about 50 micrograms per mil. So there's no question. But it's really a continuum. And we've shown in other papers that the estimate of MIC depends on the density. So if I increase the density of cells, particularly for some drugs like oxacillin and daptomycin, is awful. If I do the experiment where I start with 10 to the 7 cells rather than 5 times 10 to the 5, the estimated MIC is much higher. So the question is, what is the real minimum inhibitory concentration? And so, but the criteria, so I'm giving you a biased but accurate view of what it is. So what they do is, so the MICs are made under optimum conditions for the drug, which is, if you're the drug company, of course you want it to be under optimum conditions for the drug. And there's two groups. In the United States, it's the CLSI, I forgot what it is, a clinical group, and then you actually have to pay for the protocol. And in Europe, it's called UCAS, the European, and that's online. And you could get all of these data from UCAS online, and they'll tell you what a breakpoint is. And the physicians will not use an antibiotic if the MIC is above the breakpoint. And one area under the curve or peak antibiotic concentration divided by the MIC as the unique parameter. And it doesn't account for much of what non-inherited resistance or the realities of bacterial infections, but when they're doing it experimentally, what they do is use often neutropenic mice. So you get the mouse, and you treat it with cyclophosphamide, virtually no neutrophils. You treat within 2 hours of infection. And then look at the rate of clearance. And it really doesn't account for much of non-inherited resistance. It doesn't account for the immune system. And this is a standard, and we refer to it as the gold standard. It's not all that, but much of it is that. And so then they would use these indices to guide the treatment design. And I think, and they show correlations with success. On the other hand, you don't know whether you have anything optimal. And it's also directed at the worst case situation. And so for many years, we've been using Hill functions. And I could show them, there's lots of papers showing how well they fit. So the Hill function is that we use, instead of just, MIC is just one parameter. And so this A is the antibiotic concentration, this is the net growth at death rate, this is the maximum growth rate, this is the minimum growth rate, the maximum kill rate, and kappa is a shape function. And this is what we've been trying to promote instead of using MICs. And part of the reason is, these are made up, but they're in the range. So if I was considering a drug like, say, erythromycin, and all of these have the same MIC, so from the MIC, you would not know what the drug is doing. But they then superimpose what they call time-dependent and constant. So this would be something like ciprofloxacin. This would be something like vancomycin. This would be something like erythromycin. And the actual curves look very much like that. And so what we're particularly interested in is, this is a sub-MIC. In the sub-MIC, we're predicting very different functional relationships based on that Hill function. And so that's basically what we've been doing in that TIM paper. And Eric, this is what I was mentioning a little bit this morning or whenever we were talking about it. If I look at the maximum growth rate at sub-MIC, tetracycline, erythromycin, and linazolid give us these nice exponential things. If I just look at the maximum growth rate as a function of concentration, the cytal drugs go with a more linear relationship, which is sort of interesting. Oxacillin, and I'll show you what the oxacillin is like, a penicillin. I mean, all of the beta-lactam antibiotics. So we're getting a more linear relationship with these bacteria. These are empirical data. And but there's some really curious thing, and this is what I was mentioning. This is, you know, Olin, this is why I think we're really going to have to get at what's happening with the cells. If I take ciprofloxacin and treat at different concentrations and look at the growth dynamics, this is the black is untreated. As I increase the concentration, I'm increasing the lag, I'm increasing all sorts of things. If I look at oxacillin, the exponential growth rate isn't changing, but it just comes off at different times. This is all below the MIC. So there's some funky things going on, and I think understanding those funky things is really going to have to be looking at single cells and what they're doing. So this is, you know, I'm just bringing this up because I think it's a really interesting issue of what the hell is happening when a bacteria is confronted with an antibiotic. It's, they're not, you know, as Olin points out, it's not there as if they're all going to die or something like that. And why do you have a distribution? And why does this this happening? So I think there's some really cool questions, even at the, you know, maybe not as relevant clinically, but still of real interest. And this is where we've been going, is these models where we have the joint action of antibiotics and so on. And that's what I was wanted to do, other than I could go rant on about our work, but I just think there's some really cool questions, like is resistance increasing monotonically? If not, why not? Is can we do better? I mean, we're pushing, you know, using lower doses of antibiotics would be a good thing from not only economically, you know, but rather reduce the intensity of selection for resistance if we could reduce the dose. If we could reduce the term, we'd be reducing not intensity of selection only on the target bacteria. Because every time we take a drug, we're sort of taking, you know, we're screwing up our microbiome, as Marty Blaser wrote a whole book about. You know, we're selecting for resistance. And I told people that I tried it experimentally a number of years ago. I told the physician I had a cough and I wanted tetracycline. And I estimated the frequency of tet-resistant E. coli in my feces. You know, technically, I won't go into how you do that, or I won't go into how you sample. But if you want to do the experiment, just plate on minimal lactose, because everything grows on minimal lactose is E. coli, aerobically. And just use minimal lactose with different concentrations of antibiotics. It went from 10 to the minus 4 to 1 in one dose. And I didn't follow through to see how rapidly it declined. Stuart Levy apparently did a similar experiment, and I think it would be kind of fun to, I wanted to do it with my class, but they weren't so keen on the idea. Because some of them are taking antibiotics, and then you could just follow it. And, you know, it's clearly not a very invasive procedure. So we're really selecting for resistance in the enteric flora and the skin flora and so on. So reducing antibiotic use would be a good thing if we can get away with it. And our models say that if the immune system is adequate, we can get away with it. And that's what we're doing experimentally with mice, actually, and Bordetella using with Eric Carvel. And so we end this paper by saying hypotheses are to be tested and not championed, and certainly not implemented. And that's pretty much where we are. But what I had hoped for today was to sort of start this discussion. I think we as this group are in a particularly good position. I mean, the people that are doing and designing antibiotic treatment regimes, many of them think of a quantitative paper as one where the pages are numbered. I mean, the kind of quantitative stuff we do is really what's needed. And they, you know, and how we're going to influence clinicians, I think we have to collaborate with clinicians who have, like, say, Fernando in my case, and Pierre. But I think these are really good questions, even from the level of mechanism of action of antibiotics. What the hell is happening at sub-MIC? How are antibiotics actually working? And I mean, you would think we know the answers to these things, and we don't.
Can I make an interjection or intervention?
I'm going to sit down.
So I just want to push the group a little bit for a couple of reasons. One is very patriotic, which is that there's a high probability, and I can't say for sure, and I would be not supposed to say anything at all for sure, but that the Canadian government will conduct its own additional study alongside the O'Neill report and the WHO reports, and the national academies, I think, have done something here. But there's going to be something in Canada about this. And my former PhD student, who has been working on the ecology of dosing regimes, is actually probably, and again, that's unofficial, is probably going to be leading that. She's working for our version of the national academies. So I'd sort of like to be able to access a network, or help her access a network as well. And in that context, you know, I've had a few conversations in Canada with various people in the federal government. Big controversy that prevents whether, so if we agree that there's something that needs to be done, which Bruce is sort of casting in some senses some doubt on, but I think there's a general consensus growing politically that something should be done. Nothing happens, at least in Canada, because the agricultural lobby blames the health lobby, and the health lobby blames the agricultural lobby. So one place to start thinking about this, if anybody has, is to start asking empirically, what are the connections between the two? How often do drugs used in agriculture actually make people sick? You suspect it's very rare. I actually agree with you. But it's an easy way for politicians not to do anything.
Yeah, no, I went to one of their meetings, and they call it animal health. And how could anybody be against animal health organizations? I mean, you know, cute little lambs and stuff like that, you know, and they, you know, growth promotion is really interesting. What the hell is happening? Why is it working? And it really was working. You know, what is happening?
I always presumed that it was because you were just depleting a load of extra stuff that you had to do, that the immune system has to deal with.
Yeah, I think Jukes, I think, thought that as well. But I mean,
well, that's not so clear, because there is this mouse model to study salmonella, and I've always been very shocked thinking that the way you get an artificial salmonella infection is by first giving a shot of antibiotics. If you inoculate even fairly high dose, like 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 cells of salmonella, just by Gavage, the healthy cell, healthy mouse, it's just gone in one day. Right. So if you give constantly a low level of antibiotics to healthy animals, you might also completely shift the flora in a way that might give more space for some resistant pathogens that would be around. I don't
know. It can also just be metabolic, right?
Yeah.
The bacteria, there are less bacteria to eat some of the stuff that you're eating yourself. And so more of it goes to the cow.
Yeah, there was no question that it was working. For whether it's still working as well, I don't know. But if you're a chicken producer and you're producing, you know, chicken, you got a few cents a pound is a big difference. The pressure for it, you know, and then if McDonald's sells antibiotic-free chicken, you know, it's going in the right direction. But I still think that most of the antibiotic resistance problem in humans is because of human use, and not because of animal use.
If you were to make one recommendation to a decision maker with authority, what would it be? So the O'Neill report comes out and says, we need are new models for economic incentives to develop new drugs. Which, evolutionarily speaking, makes actually really good sense, because what you'd be easiest way to deal this would be to have a moving target.
Yeah, well, I mean, can you, you know, I mean, you're saying an arms race between the pharmaceutical industry and evolution.
Yeah.
I would count on evolution winning.
I entirely agree.
So I mean, I don't think, clearly, you know, you want to push for new drugs, but I mean, a new drug, so for example, daptomycin came out as a relatively recent drug. It was first developed by Lilly, and it was toxic, and then they changed the dosing regime. And a company called Cubist started developing it and pushing it as an alternative to vancomycin for MRSA. And I was told by people have been coming to us about phage therapy in a variety of ways, but and they were charging $1,000 a dose for this drug. And we bought it at the hospital because Cubist didn't want to send it to us for $150 a dose. I mean, so people are making a fortune for selling the, you know, these drugs that are under. And even you were talking about decisions. I won't mention the drug company, but they were making an alternative to linezolid. I was there allegedly for a talk, but they really wanted to know about linezolid resistance because it didn't pay for them to market their drug if, in fact, linezolid, which is going generic, is going to be still effective. So it means so you have the economic basis of, you know, whether you're going to put a new drug out there or not.
I'm wondering about, you said that one of the scandals is that we still don't know often what the mechanism of killing is of the but my understanding is in many cases we do know sort of the mode of action of the antibiotic, right? We know what molecules it acts on and roughly what it does to those molecules. So doesn't that suggest that the problem is that we do not understand well enough the physiology and the behavior of the bacteria to work out as a function of how fast you're growing, what concentration, all these things? Is this thing actually going to kill you versus slow you down versus...
I agree. I mean, you have those beautiful diagrams with pastel colors of the molecules and the sites of action of streptomycin and the others, and it gives you a feeling we understand the target, we understand the kinetics, but we don't understand, we wrote this paper on bacteriostatic antibiotics suggesting it's a distribution of ribosomes and using ribosomal RNA deletions. We show the results are consistent with the prediction of the model. It could be wrong, but why don't we know the answer? I mean, and we know what the targets are. Why does a drug like streptomycin, which also works on ribosome, is highly lethal, whereas, say, chlorpheniclone is not? And why is azithromycin, erythromycin, not lethal? And why is it lethal in some bacteria and not in others? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's really cool questions out there at the mechanistic level. I don't think I'm not the one to be asking those, but we did because nobody else was.
So I have this question about how antibiotics work. So we saw in that part, in that plot, when you take antibiotics, they go down to 1,000, but then it kind of levels off at 1,000. And so how does the final clearance of that infection happen? Because surely when you were infected with it, maybe you got 100 or 500 spores or something, and then it grew. Why does the antibiotic get it down to a low enough level? Why is that sufficient for the infection to then be cleared?
In my impression, and that's what we're working on, we think it's the immune system that does that really does the job. And the models, which are models of phagocytosis, say if the rate of phagocytosis is high enough, so that much of the clearance is due to the host system immunity, so for the really compromised people where you don't have an active immune system, But our argument is that dosing regimes were made for those, for the worst case situation, rather than the situation when your kid gets otitis media or you get sinusitis. You know you're going to get better, but it would be nice to accelerate that. And you take an antibiotic. The question is, how long should you take that antibiotic? What dose should you be using? Which antibiotic should you be using? And what's the logic behind those that are making these decisions? And that's what we're getting at, is whether that the decisions are the optimum ones. I mean, you know, and then if you're a physician, you know, you've got something to work in the past, why should you change it? And certainly I wouldn't want to be treated based on differential equations. I mean, so it really raises interesting questions about implementation. That is, even if we show in our experiments and our models, animal models, you're going to have to do it in patients, and how are you going to get that transition? And if you were introducing a new antibiotic, for example, or a new treatment protocol, you have to prove non-inferiority. That is, there are no placebo-controlled experiments. You can't, which is reasonable that you're talking about infection. So if you don't have placebo-controlled infections, what do you have to do? You just have to show the new procedure is no worse than the other.
So speaking of new procedures, especially in like recurrent C. diff infection, fecal transplantation is kind of like the new rage. Is that being thought of for like whenever you have, you know, general microbiome sort of dysbiosis sort of stuff? It seems like a lot of the time getting some new probiotics or like good microbes, rather than antibiotic administration, can fix these sort of these problems that you have.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is people don't see the individual risk of antibiotic use. I mean, the individual risk, the most profound one is pseudomembranous colitis, which is due to the growth of Clostridium difficile. And the treatment, classical treatment, was vancomycin. And the treatment that they're going more and more for is fecal enemas. That is, you put back the flora. I mean, and it's kind of hard to get that, make much profit on that, I guess. I don't know. I'm sure they could figure out a way to make much profit on that. They've been lyophilizing the feces and trying it orally and by enema and so on. But that's an effective treatment of antibiotic-associated colitis. So, I mean, it's not just probiotics. And then probiotics, are they working? That's a nice question. How are they working? And that's a...
My credit card got frozen. That's why I'm running out. My bank blocked it because I used a bad gas station. So part of my concern is this. This sounds like a conversation we had 20 years ago. Right? The question is, so my first reaction is, this whole problem is really an empirical one. Theory is not going to get us out of it. So in some ways, it's a phenomenological problem. And, you know, I hate to impose this on mice, but, my one question is, have persisters been shown to exist in a mammalian subject?
To me, the evidence is not very,
you can do these things, because I know there is a guy in the Institute, I mean, where he's doing this, where, you know, you take organs out that are infected, you take slices, you images, and you have these, you know, versions of GFP who change color as a function of how long ago they were made. And so by looking at cells and look at the color that these cells have, you can estimate crudely at what rate they've been recently growing. And then you can see that there is enormous variation.
So you treat it, those cells are the ones you see. Is that it, or?
Yeah, so you can treat, for example, and then you can see, and you can see that there are sort of places where they can be hiding and they're sitting, and you can see they haven't been reproducing, but whether they're reproducing, not reproducing because they're in a persister state, or they're just in a state where they had nothing to eat and so on, that you can't tell. But what you can tell is that there's an enormous heterogeneity of the environments that these cells experience that leads to an enormous heterogeneity in growth rates, and therefore also susceptibility to the antibiotics with which you treat, right? I think that people can show in mice models.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, years ago, Jim Bull and I did these experiments repeating some old work by H. William Smith on using phage to treat infection. And we did, in addition to phage, he also did it with antibiotics. What H. William Smith did in this paper, 1982, was he got a capsulated E. coli K1, which was isolated from a meningitis case, and he injected into the thigh of mice, and then he got phage that attacked the capsule, or just attacked the and he showed in this paper, a really very good, really very well done paper, not as quantitative as we would like maybe, but he showed that the phage were far more effective than any of the antibiotics, and particularly in single dose. In part, you know, and then Jim and I repeated these experiments with a different strain of E. coli K1 with phage we isolated from the Atlanta sewage treatment. And William Smith was right on. But the other thing we saw is that if you treat after 8 hours, nothing is working, for 8 to 10 hours. The mouse is sort of faded. And the other thing is also consistent with the macrophage phagocyte hypothesis. If you infect with 10 to the 6th, the mouse never dies. Well, not never dies. I mean, doesn't not immortal. That would have been a Nature paper for sure. But so there's a threshold, and we interpret the threshold so that if you treat with 10 to the 7th, infect with 10 to the 7th in the thigh, within 30 and 40 hours, usually between 30 and 35, the mouse dies of a rampant sepsis. If you die, treat with 10 to the 7. If you treat with 10 to the 6, you don't get that. And so we're assuming, and everything suggests mostly that they're in the phagocytes, which is also what we're seeing with the Bordetella, is that they're gobbled, and then they're not being responded to by the antibiotics, because they're phagocytosis pretty much took them up. What we did was called it a resistance competition assay. That is, you take a minority of resistant cells and a resistant to the treating drug, and then ask for the change in frequency of resistance as a measure of efficacy. If you treat within the first 8 hours, you see a high increase in the frequency of resistance. If you treat later, nothing is happening. And so they're mostly gobbled at that stage, and which is what we're sort of interested in. So it's not clear to me how antibiotics are actually working in patients. I mean, if in fact what we're seeing, and you would think, you know, well, we're doing more and more of it. So I think we're in a good shape of saying this hasn't been done and should be done, but whether we're going to be able to, you know, But we have no choice but to go to mice. And we do phagocytosis. We could do in vitro phagocytosis with neutrophils and macrophage in the lab, and we could ask how refractory they are then. But we really want to look at the whole full dynamics of that.
Could one alternative to the immune system stopping the infection be that the antibiotics attack, you know, the pathogen disproportionately, and then the other microbes are able to gain some sort of colonization resistance? So in addition to the antibiotics attacking the pathogen, you also have the other microbes preventing the pathogen from growing?
Presumably that's that we get, you know, that is a germ-free mouse is very susceptible to infection. And presumably contributing to that is in fact the established flora. And I don't know whether, you know, the established flora in the mouth is really preventing. I just don't know that answer. But if in fact we're treating, they're going to be knocked back as well. The hypothesis that Troy Day and Andrew Reed and colleagues have for low-dose chemotherapy is that normally the resistant bacteria are kept under control by competition with the dominant population. And if you use a high dose of antibiotics, you've upset that. And so therefore they're arguing for low-dose antibiotic use. We're suggesting low-dose for another reason. But I don't know what, I mean, for the way I see it is, you know, for us to sort of get to the point of testing these things with mice that are phagocytic, you know, that have various defects and so on, to address those questions. But I see it as something that evolutionary biologists and population biologists could be doing a lot more of. I mean, you know, and I think it's interesting, you know, like how, what's happening at sub-MICs? You know, how are the antibiotics actually working? And, you know, what are the dynamics of growth of sub-MIC?
So, my collaborator in Portugal, she does evolution in the mouse cubs of E. coli. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But they see all kinds of crazy things. So they need to break the initial invasion resistance of their labeled strain of E. coli. So they give some streptomycin. But then they get like coexistence of all kinds of things. So they discovered, just by chance, they discovered that they wouldn't lose the E. coli necessarily. They could get like both a kind of a resident and a new strain to coexist for a long time. They also see after almost a year or so, they can still see a coexistence of different strains with different mutation rates and so. So it's all really crazy. And that would just be then without antibiotic, but I didn't even expect it to persist for such a long time. And of course, they are also looking at like different, maybe not as systematic as you're suggesting, but they are looking at this different kinds of regimes. It's really like whatever you can imagine, it seems to be happening.
When you think about the microbial interactions, it also really throws into question how the MIC works. Because you take bacteria and you put some antibiotics in it, the bacteria dies. But if you take into account the interactions in the gut, maybe the MIC for that pathogen is higher than the MIC for the other bacteria. And so maybe you give it enough of the antibiotic to kill the pathogen, but in so doing, you also kill the other microbes. And so maybe you're like killing the pathogen, but the other microbes are like severely affected in enough of a sense that now they kill the pathogen or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, MIC is intuitively the way to go. I mean, in that, you know, you'd want to, you know, the sort of they'll tell you to keep it above the minimum inhibitory dose. But why a static similar to cytal? Why, you know, I mean, it raises many other questions. And you know, E. coli is a minority of the enteric flora, 10^-3. So it's not, you know, when you sample shit and you plate it on minimal lactose, you're looking for the aerobic bacteria that grow on minimal medium. The dominant population of Bacteroides, and those are, they're not growing, and those are the ones that are really upsetting. E. coli has great press, but it's a minor player, I think. And, you know, unless of course you get a uropathogenic one and it causes urinary tract infections or 0157, you know, I mean, they're truly good pathogenic E. coli there, cause diarrhea but most of the time they're just minorities, and a lot of diversity too, tremendous diversity within the gut.
I'm curious to know if the physicians are really interested by this kind of study.
I'm sorry.
I'm curious to know if the physician, which treat people in hospital and so on, are really interested by this kind of quantification of and efficiency of antibiotics and so on. I mean, they should be already visiting our lab to see what's happening over there, right?
Yeah.
So, well, maybe my question is more, how is it possible to develop more collaboration in between the physician and the evolutionary lab effectively?
I think it's really not very attractive work to do. I mean, I had trouble doing the mouse work, and I'd rather work with chemostats or microtidal plates and things like that. And repeatability is hard. I mean, there's a lot of variation that you know, and so as an evolutionary model, I wouldn't think of it as anything we want to do. But on the other hand, the Pseudomonas infections and cystic fibrosis patients, each of these people are doing, you know, Lenski experiments, which is kind of tragic, but and all the evolution that takes place there is nice.
I mean, I think they totally don't agree, of course, but they totally are not interested, the physicians. However, if by studying this you start to understand how these things interact with the physiology, how it depends on growth rate, how combinations of drugs are going to affect this and so on, and you can come up with treatment regimes that turn out to be much more efficient, they are going to care. Right? So, but yeah, we're not going to convince them that they have to look at quantitative data.
It depends a lot on the people, right? But I mean, it's happening still, like they don't even know the rules for like many things, right? Where, for example, if it doesn't work for the first time, that you shouldn't give the same antibiotic again if you haven't erased it. Like these kinds of things, like I see that, and I've seen this in, like, with vets, and I've also seen this with doctors, and so where they go through their day and they're busy, and you know, like I don't think that many of them have the time to actually look into, you know, what is going on in research. But I think there are a few who are actually interested, and finding those would be probably the challenge, right?
I don't know how much of, I know the kinds of things we can work on, and we've been doing it for numbers of years. It's been a substantial part of our research. We work on useless problems as well, that are just, I don't know how much impact we can have on what we would like to have. They're constrained by, as you say, their time to do the reading, but there are also other groups that make the decisions about protocols, and most physicians are following what the protocols. And so the question is, can we influence those making the protocols, not the physicians directly? I don't know. I hope so. I mean, that's really what I'm... Anyway, thank you for coming.
Thanks, Bruce.
I hope you guys who do single cell stuff will start looking at antibiotics. For example, Olin.